peace in Afghanistan before September. Today we go to Turkey, which is set to host historic Afghan peace talks. The Taliban's possible role in these talks stirs deep emotions.
In the peace negotiations, he says, the U.S. gave a lot of concessions to the Taliban, the same people who killed my colleagues.
I'm Marco Werman. Also on the show today, environmentalists trying to protect the Amazon in Brazil warn the U.S. against giving cash to the Bolsonaro government.
You cannot protect the environment by partnering with its worst enemy.
And wildfires in Cape Town, South Africa spare human life, but destroy large priceless collections in a university library.
We do face the possibility of losing things that we didn't even know fully existed.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to have you with us today. We begin in Turkey, which is set next week to host historic Afghan peace talks. Those talks may also map out how Afghanistan will be governed once U.S. troops leave. It's actually still unclear if the Taliban will join the talks, but for some Afghans exiled in Turkey, the news that Taliban officials may come to town stirs lots of emotions. The World's Shirin Jafari has our story from Istanbul.
The neighborhood of Zeytinburnu in Istanbul is like a mini Afghanistan. Most of the signs outside of businesses are in Dari, one of the main languages of Afghanistan. Restaurants advertise Afghan specialties. In a playground nearby, two women in headscarves watch over kids on a slide. They speak Dari too. Afghans have been coming to this Istanbul neighborhood for years. Some come to find work, others really see Turkey as a stop on their journey to Europe. But lately, there's been a rise in the number of Afghans who flee Afghanistan because of the threats from the Taliban. I got to speak with some of them on the rooftop of the building where they live.
Afghanistan.
25-year-old Jamil tells me he was a tailor back in Afghanistan. He learned the craft from his mom, also a tailor. Back in Afghanistan, Jamil and his family lived close to an area that was controlled by the Taliban. He says he started getting threats from the group when they found out that he makes clothes for women too. In conservative Islam, men and women who are not related are forbidden from coming into contact with each other. And the Taliban didn't like that Jamil welcomed women in his tailor shop to measure them for clothes. After getting death threats, Jamil decided it was time to leave. His journey to Turkey was a horrific ordeal, he says. He spent days on the road, walked for hours on end. For some parts of the trip, he says, he had to pay human smugglers. At one point, they loaded him into a truck packed with 28 other people, he says. Every time the truck made turns, Jamil says, his feet got crushed from the weight of the others. Some migrants fell out of the truck and they were left behind. After a while, he didn't feel the pain anymore. He was just numb. But when he made it to Turkey, he says, he was happy to be alive because he knows many others weren't so lucky. For Nusrat Parsa, the journey to Turkey was a lot smoother. He got on a plane and left Afghanistan for good. But he says that doesn't take away from the pain and trauma of being forced out of your own country. I never wanted to leave, he says. The day I boarded a plane in Kabul to come here, I cried. Parsa is a journalist, and for most of his career, he reported on the war in Afghanistan. But he says Afghanistan is much more than just a war. For example, he wanted to break the taboo surrounding the LGBTQ community in his country. And that turned out to be costly. This is one of Parsa's TV reports. He tells the story of a lesbian woman who hides her identity from her family. She says she fears they will disown her. Not long after this report aired, Parsa started getting threats. Online, on WhatsApp, messages sent to his family. The threats felt even more real because his colleagues were getting killed in targeted attacks. In the peace negotiations, he says, the U.S. gave a lot of concessions to the Taliban, the same people who killed my colleagues. Parsa was 12 years old when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan. He remembers hearing the sound of American jets and feeling elated. The Americans helped bring down an extremist group, he says. We were happy about that. But these days, that feeling is gone, and it's given way to worry and sorrow. Sorrow for not being able to return, he says, and worry about what the future holds. Both Jamil and Parsa say all they want is peace for Afghanistan. They say Americans do have a role to play in helping to find a political settlement. But at the same time, they say it's Afghans who have to unite. Parsa tells me he doesn't want to see a return to the 1990s when the Taliban ruled Afghanistan. That would be a tragedy, he says. Instead, I want to see a free Afghanistan, one where everyone can live with dignity and no one is forced to leave. For the world, Shirin Jafari, Istanbul, Turkey.
In India this evening, Prime Minister Narendra Modi called for patience as the country confronts a massive spike in coronavirus cases. Modi argued that lockdowns in parts of India should only be used as a last resort. Meanwhile, the Indian government also said it will expand the vaccine campaign to every adult. Modi's handling of the pandemic is heavily criticized, with many in India calling on him to do more. India recorded over 250,000 new infections in the last day alone. The capital, New Delhi, was forced into lockdown to keep the healthcare system from collapsing. COVID patients there are going from hospital to hospital trying to find free beds and oxygen tanks. Niraj Shetye studies Indian public policy in Mumbai.
It's just evident that we were not ready for the second wave of the coronavirus here. The health infrastructure is currently overwhelmed. People are dependent on social media for accessing basic amenities like an hospital bed. Oxygen is running out. We were facing with vaccine shortages until last week, if I'm not wrong, 2 weeks back. But we were not prepared. And it's very heart-wrenching for someone who is on the ground who has to go through these agonies every day and notice them firsthand. So the situation is just, it's terrible. And I think this is one of the worst days that India is witnessing in the past 1 year of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, that's stunning to hear. So you say India was not prepared. I mean, it's a full-blown crisis now, as you say. How much of this was anticipated?
I understand that, you know, India is a huge country in terms of population, but that shouldn't be an excuse. The entire onus was completely put on the population. The central government is in denial that there is a crisis. We have elections going on in 5 states in the middle of the second wave. I don't think, I mean, the Indian authorities took it as seriously as they should have. I mean, they should have learned a lot of these things. We have experts who have been warning the government that the situation would be deteriorating further. However, I don't think the experts took it quite seriously.
So overall lack of preparedness, how are people reacting to that? I mean, is there any kind of anger among Indians right now toward the government's handling of the situation?
Firsthand, if I have to tell you, yes, there is an anger. People are struggling today to find the most basic necessities, Marco. I mean, a ventilator bed, an oxygen tank. These have become privileges, right? An injection, which was supposed to be, what do you say, a necessity during an health emergency, is now people have to struggle and access the black market to fetch injections for vital COVID treatments. I mean, it's absolutely horrible to see, you know, that people are posting requests on Instagram and Twitter, requesting people. And there are some good Samaritans who have taken up this responsibility. Youth leaders from different political organizations have come up. They are helping people access these basic amenities. But the government, there is no government infrastructure in place to assist them. So that's just heartbreaking.
Niraj, what do you think happens next? I mean, will India's vaccine drive now open to all adults? Will it be able to bring down the number of cases in the country? And do you think it's a sign that the Indian government is responding in a more adequate way in the face of this full-blown crisis now?
let's see. I mean, I'm hopeful. This was a step. Opening the vaccination for everyone was everyone above the age of 18 was a necessary step. I'm just hoping that the system doesn't get overwhelmed in the vaccination strategy. I hope the vaccination strategy is in alignment with these problems.
Niraj Shetye speaking with us from Mumbai, where he's a public policy researcher and program manager at the Kanha Chahiya Foundation. Niraj, thank you very much for this update.
Thank you, Mark.
There is shocking news today out of the African nation of Chad.
C'est avec une profonde amertume que nous annonçons au peuple tchadien le décès ce mardi 20 avril 2021.
President Idriss Deby has died, according to that announcement from the Chadian army. He was in power for more than 30 years. Just this week, President Deby was the projected winner in the country's recent election. It's also worth noting that his death comes after days of fighting between Chad's army and a rebel group. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi is following the story. Halima, what do we know so far about what happened?
Sure. Well, we're still waiting for some details, and what we know right now comes from the army, so a lot of it hasn't been independently confirmed. But earlier today, the army spokesperson came on state television surrounded by other members of the military and announced that President Deby had died from injuries at the battlefront, which was a big surprise.
So injuries on the battlefront, what led up to this?
Well, there had been fighting for about a week in the northern part of the country. And according to the army, they said that rebels who they referred to as mercenaries or terrorists had entered the country from neighboring Libya, which is to the north of Chad. And they said they entered on April 11th, which was election day. And we understand that those rebels are members of the Front for Change in Concord in Chad, which goes as FACT for short. And they're a rebel group that is based in southern Libya. And things really heated up over the weekend, when FACT, the rebel group, said that they had secured a province in the north and then foreign embassies, including the U.S. and the U.K. said that they were making their way towards the capital. And the U.K. actually advised its citizens to leave the country, and the U.S. told its embassy staff or primary embassy staff to leave. So they were making a big deal about it. But on the other hand, the government, including the Ministry of Communications, the military, the foreign affairs minister, kept saying that everything was under control. They called for calm. They said they had killed hundreds of rebels. And I also spoke with a Chadian researcher who's in the capital of N'Djamena yesterday. He was willing to speak with me on tape, but he didn't want to give his name because of security concerns. But this is how he described yesterday.
There was some moment of panic, you know, earlier today. But actually, the situation is calm.
So calm in the capital, N'Djamena. So one thing I'm still trying to figure out, and many of us are, is how things went from being calm to, within less than 24 hours, the president being announced dead.
So what do we know about this rebel group that the Chadian army says is responsible for the death of the president?
So the government refers to them, again, as terrorists or mercenaries from Libya, and we understand that to mean that it's FACT, or the Front for Change in Concord in Chad, which is a rebel group that is, as I mentioned before, based in the south of Libya, in the Fezzan region. And I recently spoke with Anas Al-Ghamati. He's a Libyan analyst who heads the Sadak Institute, which is a think tank based in Tripoli.
FACT rebels have been there for several years. I mean, the estimates go from 700, according to the group itself, to, you know, 1,500 to 2,000, according to the UN. But those groups have you know, been able to move around in southern Libya.
So a president who'd been in power in Chad for 30 years now leaves this void. I've seen reports, Halima, that President Deby's son is now in line to take over for an interim period before a new election. What's next for Chad in this uncertain phase?
Yes, the army announced it will be creating a military transition council, and that will be headed by Mohamed Idriss Deby, who's the son of the now deceased president. But it seems like there could be tough times ahead. There's a big concern about what Deby's death will mean for security in the country and in the region.
The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi with the latest on the death of Chad's president Idriss Deby. Thank you very much, Halima.
Thank you, Marco.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. For several days now in South Africa, a wildfire in Cape Town has engulfed the slopes of the city's famed Table Mountain. Helicopters and hundreds of firefighters with hoses were rushed to the scene. So far, fortunately, there have been no human casualties, but the flames did serious damage to the campus at the University of Cape Town, including parts of the university's library, which houses priceless collections of African books and archives. To hear more about what was lost and saved and what this means, I'm joined by Saul Dubow. He's an honorary professor of African studies at the University of Cape Town and worked at that library for 40 years. He joins me from Cambridge, England. I understand, Saul, that a full assessment of the damage is still not out, but what do we know so far about what was lost in the library?
Well, it's a moving story. What looked initially to be a complete catastrophe, if you saw the flames coming out of the reading room of the Jaggar Library, now looks more like a calamity. I'm told that this afternoon the librarians were able to go down into the basement. Fortunately, the fire doors, which were recently installed and which housed much of the manuscript collection, seem to have held, though apparently there has been water damage. So we don't know exactly. What we do know is, and this is yet to be fully confirmed, is that perhaps the most important collection, the so-called Blake Lloyd collection of Kham or Bushman mythology and language, which was assembled from the mid-19th century into the 20th century, has been saved. We don't know yet about the other manuscript collections, and there's something of a paradox here because the Blake Lloyd collection, precisely because of its value and scholarly importance, has been worked on by many scholars and to some extent digitized. But there are hundreds of collections of private papers, manuscripts relating to the history of the university, relating to the history of the anti-apartheid movement, human rights, the churches, and so forth, which were only lightly catalogued in many cases and not always worked at in great depth. So we do face the possibility of losing things that we didn't even know fully existed.
Saul, can you draw us a picture of this part of Cape Town? I mean, the fires began on Sunday on the lower slopes of Table Mountain. Where is the university in relation to the mountain?
The university, which was constructed in the 1920s, a sort of great piece of architecture on the lower slopes of the university, was part of the estate of Cecil Rhodes, the in many ways notorious colonial magnate who gifted the land. And the fire started close by at Rhodes Memorial, which is a sort of commemorates him. It then spread, and once it got to the university, which nestles at the foot of Table Mountain, certain buildings ignited, others didn't. The fire seems to have jumped.
You worked at the library, as I said, for 40 years, Saul. What are you feeling today about this damage to the library?
Oh, like many of my colleagues, I'm completely distraught. You know, the experience of working in a library as an academic is a very particular one. People perhaps think of libraries more like information systems, things online that you can sort of access. But it's only when you're in a library, when you go through the portals, when you see what's on the wall, when you look at the layers and accretion of culture, that all adds to the atmosphere. I mean, I have a potential personal loss in that my father was a professor at the university for many years, was a photographer, and gave his entire collection of negatives and prints to that library, which may have been destroyed. So there is a personal sense of potential loss. But I certainly am enormously relieved that much more important collections, core collections, look as though they have been saved.
Saul Dubow is an honorary professor of African studies at the University of Cape Town and worked at that library for 40 years. Saul, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Carbon emissions know no border, so the Biden administration is negotiating a deal to help save Brazil's Amazon rainforest. Candidate Biden's environmental platform included big money to help curb rampant deforestation there. Here he is in March of last year in a primary debate.
I would be right now organizing the hemisphere and the world to provide $20 billion for the Amazon, for Brazil no longer to burn the Amazon so they could have forests.
And now the checkbook is open. Administration officials have been meeting with members of Brazil's government to work out a multi-billion dollar deal. But environmentalists in Brazil are urging the Biden administration to reconsider. Joining me now is Carlos Rittel. He's the former head of the Brazilian Climate Observatory. It's a network of 50 civil society organizations in Brazil. So the Climate Observatory, Carlos, was one of nearly 200 NGOs that wrote a letter to the Biden White House telling them not to send money to the Bolsonaro government to stop deforestation. Why stop this deal?
Well, you can't stop a bulldozer rushing over forests and indigenous people by shooting this with big money. And Bolsonaro, when he was elected, he declared a war against the Amazon indigenous people. And you won't turn him with a big package of money into an environmentalist who will protect the Amazon and indigenous people.
Well, Ricardo Salles, the environment minister for Bolsonaro, he's asking the U.S. government for $1 billion a year to reduce forest clearing by 30 to 40%. How do you see that money actually increasing deforestation?
Any money flowing to the hands of Ricardo Salles and Bolsonaro's administration related to the Amazon would foster further destruction. Right now, he's moving ahead an agenda, a series of bills at the National Congress that aim to open indigenous lands, to legalize wildcat mining and large agribusiness, legalizing land grabbing, the steal of public lands at large scale.
I mean, the Amazon is one of the largest, most important forests in the world when it comes to carbon storage. It's also one of the most biodiverse places on the planet. What do you say to negotiators who are saying that a deal cannot wait, that Bolsonaro, yeah, he may be no champion of the environment, but isn't this deal better than nothing?
Well, I would say that there are different ways to help Brazil to protect the Amazon, including speaking with subnational governments, civil society, a series of scientific institutions that are working on the ground. You cannot protect the environment by partnering with its worst enemy. If the Biden's administration wants to really help Brazil to set up a path of sustainable development in the Amazon, there are different routes.
Would it make a difference to you if it were a larger group of nations that was bringing pressure on Bolsonaro and Brazil?
There are different ways that this pressure could be effective. For example, Bolsonaro's administration wants to have Brazil join the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The U.S. administration has a strong power there. If the accession of Brazil to those OECD, for example, is tied with environmental commitments, this would be a much better way to ensure that Bolsonaro could do something about the environment rather than giving him the money directly. So this is not the lack of money to protect the forest. The problem is that there is no political willingness to do so.
Carlos Rittel joined us from Potsdam, Germany, where he's a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies. He's the former director of the Brazilian Climate Observatory. Carlos, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Marco. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
You're listening to The World. Rising tensions between the U.S. and Russia. A former ambassador to Moscow doubts they'll ease up anytime soon.
No side ever wins. They just keep fighting.
Also ahead, a court in Berlin rules against rent control.
It's a big defeat for all people who have to rent their apartments here in Berlin.
It was really strong rent control, and yes, some residents are furious. Coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Let's go now to the tensions between Washington and Moscow, which are escalating practically by the day. Today, the State Department said that the U.S. ambassador to Russia, John Sullivan, will be returning to the United States this week. In his statement, Ambassador Sullivan said he would like to speak with the Biden administration about the current state of bilateral relations between the United States and Russia. This comes just a week after the U.S. and Russia imposed sanctions on each other. We're joined by former U.S. Ambassador to Moscow, Michael McFaul. Ambassador, what do you make of all of this? How significant is it that both ambassadors from Russia and the U.S. are not at their posts right now?
Well, I think it's disappointing. I think it's a mistake. I thought it was a mistake for Ambassador Antonov to go back to Moscow. That's some symbolic act that has no practical significance. This is the 21st century, Marco. You can do consultations with your capital on various platforms. I most certainly did when I was a U.S. ambassador in Moscow. And second, I think Ambassador Sullivan, I understand he wants to meet the new team. Remember, he is a political appointee from the Trump administration. So it's somewhat unusual even that he kept the job. And I understand he wants to meet the new team. These are people he doesn't know. But I also think it's a precarious moment when we do not have senior people in capitals. That means communications are weaker than they should be at a time when tensions are very high.
Yeah. As for Ambassador Sullivan, do you believe his return to Washington was a forced move by Russia? I mean, the Kremlin did say that they would like Ambassador Sullivan to return to the U.S. for consultations, and here we are.
Yeah, I mean, Foreign Minister Lavrov said it in his very particular way that he did, using the passive tense. I used to work with Foreign Minister Lavrov, and he has a way with words. And initially, Ambassador Sullivan said he wasn't going to go back. And let's be clear, nobody has been declared persona non grata, PNG'd, right? That would have been an escalatory step that the Russians could have taken and did not, thankfully. But then Ambassador Sullivan changed his mind and he'll come back. And it's good for him, of course, to meet the new team and understand their strategy. I just don't like it when there's not high-level diplomatic engagement when tensions are high.
I mean, with Sullivan returning to Washington, Russia is bound to see the U.S. playing to their suggestion. What do you see as kind of possible downsides there?
Well, President Biden, in his remarks announcing the expulsions of diplomats and the new sanctions, also made very clear that he wants a stable relationship with Russia, a stable relationship with President Putin. And he even, surprisingly to me, offered to hold a summit with President Putin in a third country somewhere in Europe. And so I saw a genuine effort on behalf of the president and the Biden administration to say, okay, let's put a period to that era and now move forward. The problem is, I'm not sure that Vladimir Putin wants a stable relationship with the United States. The buildup he's done on the borders of Ukraine suggests that he likes instability. He likes uncertainty. And it's most certainly my view that he needs the United States as an enemy, as part of his argument domestically for why they're taking such a hard line with the West and blaming the West, as he often does, for the economic woes that they have at home. So I appreciate President Biden's attempt to stabilize and have dialogue with President Putin, but it takes two to tango. And I'm just not sure that Putin wants to engage in that right now.
So it's complicated. And because it is, it would not be surprising if there's some disagreement within the administration on how the U.S. should approach Russia. Ambassador, can you take us behind the scenes? What do those debates and conversations sound like? What can you tell us?
I think there is considerable debate, and they're having debates about very issues, about whether or not, for instance, to offer a summit with Putin. Many saw that as a concession and a response to his buildup of forces on the Ukrainian border. Second, there's a debate about whether Putin should be included in multilateral platforms and negotiations. And I'll just note that he was invited and has decided to attend the climate summit that President Biden will be hosting later this week.
So what side is going to win in this internal debate?
Oh, Marco, no side ever wins. They just keep fighting, which is, this is a difficult, hard portfolio, right? And you can say all you want in the White House Situation Room, but then Russia gets to react. I do think the administration probably underestimated how much time Russia is going to take. My sense is that they were completely focused on the China challenge, and they just thought they could just extend the New START treaty for 5 years, start strategic stability talks with mid-level officials in Russia, and then park that bilateral relationship off to the side. I think Putin's not going to go along with that and will demand, therefore, much more attention from more senior administration officials than I think they were originally planning for.
So this idea of a summit between Biden and Putin, could it happen at some point this summer? And what could actually be accomplished given the level of tension right now?
I agree with President Biden that he should talk to President Putin. I was at the last meeting they had, by the way, March 2011. Biden was vice president and Putin was prime minister. That's 10 years ago. So it's good for them to talk. I agree with that. I'm not so sure a bilateral summit, a standalone summit, was the best idea because that creates all kinds of expectations. And my prediction is there won't be any deliverables, as we call them, from the summit. But I think it was the right move because you do not want conflict based on misperception. I would prefer to have some dialogue so that if we do have conflict, it's based on a correct reading of his preferences and what he's doing and not an incorrect, and vice versa. I want Putin to understand what President Biden is trying to do as well.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, speaking with us about the latest in the U.S.-Russia diplomatic relationship. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Always great to talk to you, Marco.
If you rent, this'll sound dreamy, a rent freeze for a minimum of 5 years with the right to sue your landlord if they jack the rent up. Until a few days ago, this was the reality for tenants in Berlin. A German court has now ruled that the rent control measure was unconstitutional. Some Berlin tenants say they won't take this lying down, as the World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
I first met Jenny Stupka in her apartment in Berlin in 2019, shortly before the rent freeze was introduced. Stupka's rent had jumped by 40% over the previous 6 years, and the rent cap, she told me, would be a huge relief.
We welcome the freeze as a kind of little break for the sleepless nights of tenants in Berlin.
But a year and a half later, Stupka's sleepless nights are back.
This rent cap has had a huge impact on my very personal rent. And now, like, it's a big defeat for all people who have to rent their apartments here in Berlin.
And that's a lot of people. In fact, more than 85% of the population of Berlin are renters. So the left-leaning Berlin state government knew it would be a popular move when they put the freeze in place. But last week, the country's constitutional court ruled the Berlin authorities had no right to do so. The rent cap, the court said, infringed on existing federal law. And it's not the only bad news for Berlin renters.
Some of the most outrageous consequences of this judgment now is that a lot of households, especially those that the rent cap applied most to, will have to pay back huge amounts of money now.
Landlords can now demand back payment from tenants for the 12 months the rent freeze was in place. And they're free to hike up rents as well. Stupka says this means many tenants may be forced to give up their apartments. Before the cap was introduced, rents in Berlin had shot up because of rising numbers of people moving to the city. But compare Berlin rents to London, Paris or many US cities and the price doesn't seem so bad. Barbara Steenbergen with the International Union of Tenants says the comparison is unfair.
Do not forget, we do not have the same salaries in Berlin like you have it in New York or you have it in London or have it in Paris or even have it in Munich or in Frankfurt. Berlin salaries, the wages are very, very low, so the people earn less.
Steenbergen says she's really disappointed by the court's decision, but it's not the end of the road. She points out that the court ruling found the Berlin government's bill was unconstitutional, not the rent freeze itself.
So this gives us possibilities to have a rent cap not only in Berlin, but also all over Germany. And this is the chance we are going to take.
They plan to take their campaign nationwide. Of course, not everyone in Berlin is unhappy with the news. Christian Ostus is with IVD, an industry group that represents more than 6,000 real estate agents and property managers across Germany. When I met him in 2019, he was convinced the rent freeze would be defeated in court. Today, he says, he's relieved he was proven right.
Because now this spook is over. So and now we have a clear situation for landlords and tenants. And I think this is what we should welcome.
Critics of rent control say while it helps those who are already renting, it makes things much more difficult for first-time tenants. There's less movement in the market and developers have fewer incentives to build new homes. Ostho says for the last year, many investors just went elsewhere.
I know from several investors that they shifted their investments to the rural areas around to the suburbs of Berlin and some went to other cities. And now I hope they gain back the confidence to invest in Berlin.
But tenants groups say they're not backing down. Thousands marched through the streets of Berlin, banging pots and pans after the ruling was announced. And more protests are planned. A recent survey showed a majority of Germans nationwide are in favour of a rent freeze. And with a general election on the cards for later this year, rent control is likely to be a campaign issue in the weeks ahead. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
If you do happen to have the cash to travel outside the US, you'll know about the State Department travel advisories for different countries. There's a ranking system from a level 1 risk, advising a normal amount of caution, to a level 4 risk, meaning do not travel there. Yesterday, the State Department announced because of the quote unprecedented risk of coronavirus, 80% of the world's countries would soon fall under level 4, no-go zones. So joining such places as Afghanistan and North Korea now are Canada, Mexico, Kenya, Peru. just a few of the countries on the updated list with a level 4 advisory. The State Department says these updates consider the availability of local testing and treatment, as well as travel restrictions on U.S. citizens. They also say they're making this move to better align with CDC standards about travel safety and the pandemic. The CDC, meanwhile, is mostly discouraging non-essential travel altogether, even if you're vaccinated. Here's Director Rochelle Walensky earlier this month.
While we believe that fully vaccinated people can travel at low risk to themselves, CDC is not recommending travel at this time due to the rising number of cases.
The CDC also adds that traveling internationally, even if you're vaccinated, poses risks because of new COVID variants. So if you were thinking, hey, maybe I can book a flight now, you may want to content yourself with the view from your living room window for just a bit longer. Treasure hunts. They're not just for pirates. In France, there's an antique collector who's buried two halves of a key. The whole key will unlock a golden casket worth nearly $1 million. Now, one half of the key is hidden somewhere in France. The other half is in the UK. You can find the two key halves if you can solve a series of riddles. We're really playing up this treasure hunt thing, aren't we? Here's the point we really want to make. The story behind the casket is just as fascinating as the hunt itself. From the south of France, Rebecca Rossman has that.
It's a story about understanding friendship and cooperation. It all started in London in the summer of 1903 when King Edward VII, a huge Francophile, gifted French President Emile Loubet with a golden chest, meant to symbolize a friendship between France and the UK.
It's a very sort of Edwardian piece. It's not by any means sort of, Art Deco minimalism. It's very flamboyant.
Stephen Clark is a Paris-based historian and author of books including A Thousand Years of Annoying the French.
Britain and France were not the best of friends at that time.
But the two leaders were, and several months after this exchange of the golden casket, Loubet and Edward VII went against their own governments to sign a series of peace agreements known as the Entente Cordiale, just before World War I.
It was a very, very important agreement, really, because it meant that Europe was more balanced. Without it, it might have been Britain, Germany, Russia against France. I'd say the First World War would have lasted about 2 weeks.
The Entente Cordiale is still regularly cited in the history books, but the golden casket associated with it was all but forgotten. Until now.
Here is the golden casket.
And it's all thanks to this man, Michel Becker, an artist and antique collector who discovered the casket at auction several years ago. It's now sitting at his chateau in the south of France. He takes me into his library and opens up an old china cabinet and carefully gives me the object.
It's in my hands, the golden casket. It's beautiful. And it's kind of heavy.
Becker isn't just a collector.
Je suis un artiste, mais je suis aussi, à la base, un créateur.
I'm an artist, he says, but I'm also a creator, painting, sculpture. The common theme in all these activities is creation. These passions combine in his puzzles. He created a treasure hunt in 1993 for a golden owl that still hasn't been solved. The hunt for the golden treasure of the Entente Cordiale is his latest concept, launched earlier this month. To play, all you need is his book of riddles and two special maps, one of France and one of the UK.
On peut le faire dans son fauteuil français, dans son fauteuil anglais.
He says you can do it in your French armchair, an English armchair, or even an American rocking chair. It's a question of solving riddles, of finding things, of deep thinking, he says. In a few months, the casket will be locked up inside a museum in the western town of Rochefort. Solve the clues, and they'll lead you to two halves of a key to unlock the casket. One half buried in France, the other half buried in the UK. Becker himself doesn't know how to solve the mystery. He hired game master Vincenzo Bianca to design the treasure hunt. His advice?
Keep it simple. When you're in front of a riddle, just try to think it simple. And when you try every simple thing, then think complicated. But don't think complicated at first.
Unlike the golden owl, Bianca expects the hunt for the golden casket to take around 1 to 5 years to solve. It will be easier once travel lockdowns have eased. And if two different people find one half of the key, they'll split the prize together.
It's a scenario Becker is actually hoping for, an international cooperation honoring the symbolism of the Entente Cordiale. Historian Stephen Clark says this is needed now more than ever.
Now the Brits have started causing trouble with Brexit. We're arguing about vaccines. There's a lot of political tension.
But Clark says the Entente Cordiale shows that this tension is just short term. In the long term, there will always be an entente or understanding between France and the UK. Michelle Becker hopes this treasure hunt can serve as a reminder of that. For the world, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Avignon, France.
There is a lot of news. It can be hard to keep up. Here's one good way to stay globally connected. Subscribe to our daily newsletter, Top of the World. Just sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. Among the greatest horrors of the 20th century, the genocide that swept through the Central African nation of Rwanda in 1994. In roughly 100 days, ethnic Hutu extremists slaughtered some 800,000 people. This week, Rwanda's government released a new report about the origins of the killing spree. It concludes that France played a significant role in enabling a foreseeable genocide. In the decades since the massacres, Rwandans have enjoyed some peace and stability. Many in the West credit Rwandan President Paul Kagame, the former rebel leader. But author Michaela Wrong says the truth about Kagame is far more sinister. Wrong's new book is called Do Not Disturb. In it, she tells the story of dissident Colonel Patrick Karegaya, who was once the Rwandan president's right-hand man.
He was a charmer who used to sort of deal with the media. When you went to Kigali and you were hoping to interview Kagame, you would end up meeting this man and having a beer with him. And he made a point of cultivating journalists and spy chiefs and diplomats and government ministers all around the world. He had an incredible contact list. This is a man who was one of Paul Kagame's closest friends, knew him as a child, went to the same school with him, became a rebel with him when they were young men, joined then the secret army, which became the Rwandan Patriotic Front, rose to the top of the echelons of the intelligence service under Kagame, was his closest aide, his most trusted confidant, and then fell out with him, as many people have done. I mean, I use Patrick's story, but there are many people who have gone through this trajectory, fell out with him, realized that if he stayed in Rwanda, he was going to be a dead man, fled to South Africa. And he was hunted down by his old friend, his best mate, who sent four killers to get him. And they succeeded on New Year's Day 2013. And he was found, his body was found strangled to death in a South African hotel.
Karegaya's killers apparently hung a sign on his hotel room, Do Not Disturb, giving them time to escape, and thus the title for your book. Why is Kagame doing this? I mean, why does he kill his critics?
I think it's a pattern you see in other hardline regimes where you have a group of former guerrillas. I mean, this has happened in Eritrea. Some people feel something similar has been happening in Uganda. We've seen it in Eastern Europe. You see this across the world. These young men who were all together side by side, they felt they shared the same ideals, and then they win power. And what happens is one of them, or maybe a couple of them, emerge as the key guy and then sets about, because he looks around him and sees that these people are possible rivals. And also they are not averse to telling him when he is doing wrong. And he finds himself intolerant of criticism.
You are an unabashed Kagame critic, Michaela, but he did turn the page from violent divisions in Rwanda. I mean, do you give him any credit for improving life in the country under his stewardship?
I'd just like to say that I didn't start off an unabashed Kagame critic. And I think that I've been through a trajectory, you know, many journalists and observers and aid workers and diplomats have gone from sort of seeing Kagame and the RPF as people who ended the genocide to then firstly asking some questions about how that genocide started and the role that the Rwandan Patriotic Front played in creating this toxic environment in which the killing took place. But then the other thing is there have been huge amounts of evidence of bloodletting under Kagame, in which tens of thousands and possibly hundreds of thousands of Hutus who had fled away from the government were hunted down in the forests of Congo.
Right. But anyone who's visited Kigali recently has noticed it's humming economically. It is clean. It works. How do you factor that into Paul Kagame's stewardship of the country?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's very impressive. I've been to Kigali too, and I too marveled at the cleanliness and the fact that there were high-rise towers where you know, there didn't used to be before. But is the necessary price of that, that so many people have had to die, is it a necessary corollary of that, that, you know, no one can speak their mind on television or on YouTube or in the press without being arrested and then disappearing? Because that seems to be the deal.
Mm. Is it possible that Kagame is motivated by a sort of post-genocide, never again philosophy, and whether you want to call it ego or trying to save his country, how much is Kagame simply this post-genocide president with that very heavy baggage?
The baggage he bears on his shoulders is enormously heavy. But I think what's worrying is that you have a system in which no one is willing to put down that baggage. And no one is willing to, despite the fact that there's a lot of kind of playing up of the fact that now in Rwanda, no one is ever described as either Tutsi or Hutu. They're all just Rwandans. That's a great thing. But at the same time, everyone is achingly aware of the genocide and its legacy. And one of the tricks that the RPF plays is to constantly remind Hutu civilians that they are complicit, they have blood on their hands, even if they weren't even alive, because they're too young, they weren't even alive when the genocide was perpetrated, that they bear a kind of ancestral guilt for the mass slaughter that was done by their ancestors, their fathers, their grandparents.
So Rwanda today, Michaela, is it a police state? I mean, could you visit there today now that this book is published?
I personally won't be going back. I wouldn't be given a media accreditation or a visa if I applied for one. I'm pretty sure of that, because I do think it's a country that's incredibly intolerant of any form of criticism. I mean, I've seen this since my book has come out. I've been subjected to a storm of abuse on Twitter and in Rwandan newspapers. This is not a regime that just shrugs its shoulders when it is criticized and just says, oh, well, that's your view. Everything is taken extremely personally. And then the smear tactics get to work. So I wouldn't feel safe going there.
Michaela Wrong's new book about Rwanda is called Do Not Disturb, The Story of Political Murder and an African Regime Gone Bad. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
From Central to West Africa now, with an important stop in London. This is a compelling new recording from the London Symphony Orchestra and Toumani Diabaté, the virtuoso player of the West African harp known as the kora. We're talking classical music from two different parts of the world. Diabaté's repertoire, the classical patterns of traditional kora music, the LSO, Western classical music. Together they created the album Korolen, which translates from Mali's Mandinka language as ancestral. Treat yourself to the entire ethereal collaboration between Toumani Diabaté and the London Symphony Orchestra when Korolen comes out this Friday. The World Broadcast from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll be back again with you tomorrow.